This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as you know, if you're a listener to Intelligent Medicine, we tend to shadow the medical establishment and critically review some of the things that are done in conventional medicine. At the same time, we shine a light on some of the practices in natural medicine, evaluate them for their veracity and efficacy. And so it is, I think, right in our wheelhouse that today we talk to the founder of an organization that does precisely that. It's called MedShadow Foundation. We're going to talk to Suzanne Robati, who is an individual who has been an active participant in community life. She's on the board of New York City's Community Board 7. Gee, that's near where I live. Actually, that's across the park. That's on the west side. She's also on the board of the West Side YMCA. Sue, did you know that I'm on the board of the Vanderbilt YMCA across town from you?
Oh, we have so much in common.
We do indeed. She had a successful publishing industry career as founder of Baby Publishing LLC, but she's moved on to her work with the MedShadow Foundation. So welcome to Intelligent Medicine, Sue. It's a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Hoffman. I'm glad to be here.
So really, I think the key word here is patient advocacy. And what was it that propelled you into this arena of patient advocacy?
Well, when my kid was 12 years old, he got into sixth grade in a new school, and the teachers said to us that he was too antsy, he was too itchy, he didn't do his homework, he spoke out in class, he was ADHD, and he had to go into Ritalin right away. So I took him to a specialist.
He had to go on Ritalin. So, you know, just a typical, you know, kind of the typical move for kids who were inattentive in school. And you,
absolutely,
they say, go to a pediatric neurologist, get him to write you a prescription for some of that, in effect, what it is speed, which does help focus and concentration. But perhaps you were concerned about some of the potential ill effects.
I was very concerned. I took my son to the doctor, and he handed me the prescription within 15 minutes without a full medical checkup or any suggestion of anything but medicine. And I said to him, well, does this, will he be taking this for a long time? Yes, he'll be taking it maybe the rest of his life, he said. And I said, well, what are the effects of a child who's 12 and hitting puberty and growing up and the brain changes? You know, what are the long-term effects of this drug? And he said, I don't know, there aren't any studies on that. And I said, doesn't that concern you? And he said, no, we'd know. We've been giving it to kids long enough. We would just know if there was something wrong. It's fine.
Right. So they would have to be dropping like flies for him to, or for the medical establishment to pay attention to that phenomenon.
Well, if you're not looking for it, how are you going to find it? Truly.
Indeed.
It just amazed me. So when this kid, I was a difficult parent because I wouldn't let him take the Ritalin and I wouldn't let him take the Wellbutrin that they wanted him to take or the Adderall. I just let him struggle and work hard to develop decent study habits so that he could go off to college, which he did. And he's in college now. He's not best student ever, but he's a great, bright kid with a fun personality with, and he's not using drugs, which I'm very happy to say.
Mm-hmm.
But that is why I started MedShadow, because I know there are a lot of parents out there who, and a lot of people who are given a drug by their doctor and assume that the doctor has done a careful risk analysis on their behalf. And I'm not convinced about that.
And so you pursued focusing on this issue of the long-term effects of ADHD medication. You began to investigate this as an enlightened layperson with scientific literacy and basic intelligence. You began to look at the research. So what did that yield when you looked at research around ADHD medication?
At the time, and this was 9 years ago, I think. At the time, there were no published studies that went longer than 6 weeks.
Wow.
So within that time period, you can only tell if it's effective. But you don't even get to see that it becomes less effective the longer that you use it. So I talked to my pharmacist and asked if I was correct and that I couldn't find any longer-term studies. And he confirmed that's true. And I called my own physician and asked her thoughts. And she actually felt that Ritalin was an okay drug to use, but suggested that we try working with a coach, an ADHD coach, which was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But from ADHD, we've moved on to a wide range of different articles, everything having to do with HPV vaccines or statin drugs, HGH, human growth hormone, beta blockers. So if you go to our website, you can search and find articles and information on all of these.
So how is it that, there's so much information out there, let's take statins, for example. Recently, there was kind of a little bit of a mini scandal because a researcher had written a paper that said that people were dying because they were paying attention to statin scare stories, the suggestion being that maybe we should, curtail the First Amendment and prevent people from writing statin scare stories because it's irresponsible and people were dropping dead as a result of going off statins or not going on them. It then turned out that he was on the payroll of a couple of major pharmaceutical companies that manufacture statins, and that got out and it kind of backfired. How do you find...
That's very good. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I mean, you heard of that obviously too, because you're keeping your finger on the pulse of these stories. So, how do you make sure that you are getting reliable information, or do you act as kind of an information clearinghouse? There are certain standards you apply in terms of obtaining objective information.
Well, we work with experienced professional health journalists writing our stories, and we have a particular point of view and guidelines for those journalists. And part of it is we only hire journalists who understand how to read a research study and mm-hmm. who will look beyond just the summary and actually look at how many people are in the study, a very important thing. Many studies have 100 or fewer people in them, and that's for a drug that will go to 1 million people. So obviously it's not going to be a very broad-based study. It's going to be very narrow. The study that you're talking about, I think actually you could flag, I think it was a very... very few people on that study. You also want to see how long the study lasted and who was selected for the study. For example, flibanserin study.
Yeah, uh-huh. That's the female, the pink Viagra, the female Viagra.
Well, it's very, very different from Viagra.
No, clearly. But it's the popular designation for it. It works differently. Right. It doesn't work on the hydraulics of sexual arousal. It works on the brain.
Yes, exactly. It was designed, it was tested only on women premenopausal between the ages of, I think, 30 and 40, 45, something like that. Yet, most of the women who have any kind of sexual dysfunction tend to be after menopause. So it wasn't studied on the most likely mm-hmm. user group. Even within the flibanserin phase, it was famously pointed out that the alcohol study, because you have to do studies within studies and see how drugs interact with common uses, So they studied how what would happen if you were on probation and drank, and they only used one woman in that study, and the rest were men. Men aren't supposed to take probation, so I don't know why the FDA accepted a study with men as the subject group. But this is what a good health journalist and a good researcher looks at, and that's why we hire the best journalists that we can find in the industry.
So in effect, what you're doing is you're providing sort of vetted and pre-digested health information for consumers, and without a decidedly anti-drug bias, but perhaps with a little enlightened skepticism about some of the claims.
We're a hub. Where our goal is to be a one-stop place. We should be your second stop on the internet. We know, let's say you go to the doctor and he says, well, you need to be on statins. And so you go home and you look it up on WebMD or Mayo Clinic, the general information on statins. The next place you go to is MedShadow. Look up statins on MedShadow and find out what are the long-term side effects of statins? How do they interact with other drugs? And what does this mean for the rest of your life? So, yes, that's our goal. And I forgot the second half of your question.
It's okay. Often when we look at studies, one of my mottos is follow the money trail. You know, find out if there's built-in bias, influence, if the authors, for example, have received honoraria from pharmaceutical industry sources. What about your source of funding? Do you have any access to Grind?
Well, you've asked a very good question. And that's one of the things we always look for in the research studies is who funded it. And at some point, we should have a long discussion just on how you analyze a research study because there's so many interesting things to look at.
Right. I actually recently wrote an article to that effect at drhoffman.com for our intelligent medicine subscribers. But, you know, I'm sure you've got a similar take on it, that there are a variety of ways that you look at studies, you know, study size, you know, the age and sex of the participants, you know, all these things are very important.
Who dropped out and why?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you were really asking me, who funds MedShadow?
Yep.
Very good question. We do not take any pharmaceutical funding. We never will. We don't take money from medical device manufacturers, and we don't take money from hospital organizations, health organizations like that. That makes it tough to get funding. But presently, we have private funding. We're funded by people who come to our website and donate money, and several private family foundations.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that sounds like you're free of the usual bias that encumbers many sites. And also, some of the natural medicine sites often have an agenda because they're promoting products that, you know, you can click on, you know, just scroll down and you click on a product that they've just rated highly. So, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a conflict of interest there.
Well, here's a funny story for you. We don't sell any products, and I think that's something you need to look at when you look at a website is, you know, what is their agenda? How do they get their money, and do they sell product? But I ran across a study I shared with my husband that showed that within the bounds of the study, placebos are 70% as effective as a prescription drug, and that's a very broad generalization, and I'm pulling this out of my memory, so
yeah.
Please don't quote me, but it was something startling like that, and that even if people knew it was a placebo, that it still was 50% as effective as a prescription drug. And so my husband's suggestion is that we create a MedShadow drug brand, a placebos only.
Yeah, right.
So it'd be placebo Viagra, placebo Addy.
Absolutely. And free of side effects, quite likely.
Free of side effects, yes. Yeah. Placebo,
there's an added advantage.
And test stores, yes.
Indeed. All right, I'm curious as to your take on the HPV vaccine, because we get a lot of questions from our listeners on my radio program and via email about, you know, should my child take the HPV vaccine? I know it's controversial. There are pros and cons. And you know, what's nice, I've looked at articles on your website, and you do handle them in a balanced fashion. And usually, you know, you don't come down conclusively on one side or another of an issue. You present both sides fairly and then let the reader choose.
Mm-hmm. The HPV vaccine is still very controversial. As as a rule, I'm a huge fan of vaccinations. I had a great aunt who limped her entire life because of polio. And, you know, childhood diseases were very serious. But parents of young children today never saw what I did growing up and what people over the age of, say, 40 or 45 did growing up. And maybe they don't understand how important vaccines, they're just lifesavers. HPV vaccine's a little bit different. It hasn't been on the market very long. And its method of action isn't as clear as some other areas, and there have been studies that go both ways. This odd response of fainting within an hour of having had the shot is very strange. The fact that Japan has withdrawn its support, and I think there are a few other countries that have also withdrawn their support for the vaccine, is concerning.
Mm-hmm.
That said, at the end of the day, I personally encourage my son to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very personal decision. You should ask your daughter. We have an article on it on the website that goes through the pros and cons. That's pretty recent. We're probably going to be doing an update soon, so to come back. But I think if you go to the website, you're going to see, you'll have links to the... there are 8 questions we have within that article that you should ask your pediatrician, so that you can make your best decision. Things like, what kind of side effects have you, the doctor, seen after the shot? Or do you know of any adverse events among your patients or in this area? Would you give it to your child? And how long will it protect my child from the HPV virus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is a controversial vaccine. I mean, I agree with you that, I'm not per se an anti-vaxxer, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't suspend our critical judgment whenever a new vaccine is introduced. I think it's too often the battle lines are drawn, and it's like, go, 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 you know, take, 16 or 18 different vaccines, or you're an anti-vaxxer and you don't want to take anything. So, I think the truth lies somewhere in between. And we certainly need to do more research on the long-term effects of some of these vaccines, and perhaps just the whole issue of overall the burden, the immunological burden of lots and lots of vaccines administered early in life. Or perhaps there are certain subsets of kids or teenagers who may be more prone to adverse reactions to these things. Maybe we'll be able to discern that in the future.
Long-term studies are needed on every medicine, and quite often the FDA requires long-term studies to be conducted after the drug is approved, and almost to a company, those studies are not done, and there's no penalty for it.
And I think you probably keep track of this, what's the body count of drugs that were introduced with great fanfare over the past decade or so that have now been withdrawn? There's quite a few of them, haven't there? They passed muster at first, and then, when widely disseminated and used by millions of people, they had to be pulled from the marketplace. Isn't that correct?
Yes, very true. And some of them are just heartbreaking stories. I don't have a head count for you. It's just, there's a lot. But there's a general rule that many people, including MedChatter.org, are suggesting is that ask your doctor, is there an older drug available for me to use? The longer drug's been on the market, the more we know about it. If it's a new drug, question, why are you giving me a new drug? Is there an older one? And if it's the only one that's available for me now, did the FDA approve it for this use, or are you using it off-label?
Right. And, what I often say to patients is don't be the first kid on the block to use a new medication after it's been released, if at all possible. I mean, if it's your only alternative and it's like, potential lifesaver, okay, maybe. But as a rule of thumb, allow it to be on the marketplace for a couple of years before you adopt it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you also take aim at a popular asthma medication, Advair. Lots of our listeners who are asthmatic, they know about that. It's a popularly used medication, but there's even cautions now being issued about its potential for harm. I mean, it does a lot of good. It protects a lot of asthmatics, but it can have adverse effects. Can you explain the controversy?
You've got me at a disadvantage. I can't remember exactly. I mean, no.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay, you were going to demur. But I think there is an article maybe by one of your contributors on the website on the subject of Advair.
Yeah, and right, there's actually, we just published an article called October Overuse, Safety Questions, Cloud Advair's Ascent to Asthma Blockbuster. That's a mouthful of a headline. And it was actually written by the excellent Jeff Girth of ProPublica.
Mm-hmm. Which is another good outfit.
To write his article.
Yeah, it's a very good outfit.
That's a good outfit.
Yep.
Yeah, and part of the reason why I stumble over discussing it is because his article, it's a very complex issue.
Yeah.
And the article, which you can find on our website, is so well documented and has so much background. I mean, 3,500 people die from asthma each year.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very scary. And Advair is a very controversial drug, so I would encourage anybody who's interested in Advair or has an asthmatic person in their family to go to our website and read that article by Jeff. He's great.
Good. All right, so there's lots of resources there. And so we, as you know, Sue, we divide our podcast into two parts. So what we're going to do is let's stipulate this is part one of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast on the subject of the MedShadow Foundation. And in part two, we'll talk about some of the other articles on your website, some of your campaigns, including the Choose Wisely campaign. We'll find out what that's all about. Also, you did a series on food as medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.